The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning. It's Sunday again. It would not be any fun if we weren't sliding into our seats at the last minute. You're joining We the People Radio with Aaron.
We give him extra commercials, too.
Yeah. Aaron Ryan, Elizabeth Woodward, and our producer and a musical savant, Bob Martin. And if you haven't listened to the show before, we are all about fiscal responsibility, limited government, and adherence to the Constitution, everything that falls under that umbrella.
Heavy on the limited government.
Quite a lot. Yeah, we're really heavy on the limited government.
Good grief.
And been on the air now for almost 3 years.
Isn't that spooky?
Yeah, it just flew by.
Yeah. It's like, hey, how'd you guys like to do a show called We the People? Okay, we don't know anything about radio.
We've never done this before, but okay.
Okay.
See, that's
nice.
Yeah,
we're doing projects like that.
I do too. We're game for anything. We're both like that, though. Have never done it before, so what?
Exactly. So, a lot going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, couple of stories. You know, over the course of 3 years, we have talked to a lot of people from every walk of life who have had government breathing down their neck in some fashion, and those people at one point in time thought that they were the only ones, and then as time goes on, you find out that there are others out there like you, you know, that a lot of people have encountered government intervention, if you will. So couple of things that I heard about this week, you know, I've started a new business, and it requires collecting sales tax, and the company that I'm doing it under collects the sales tax from me, and then they pay the sales tax to the state whenever they pay it, quarterly, whatever. So anyway, I did an event a couple of weeks ago, and I used the resale number for the state of California given to me by the corporate office, and that's cool. And so the event organizers double-checked with the Board of Equalization to make sure that was, in fact, legitimate. And so I've gotten a couple of calls from Board of Equalization this week, you know, at my home.
Really?
Yeah, and I thought...
What do they want to know?
They want to make you know, just kind of verifying everything,
I guess.
Do we
get to talk about what it is?
Damsel in defense.
So, Elizabeth's hawking stun guns. Gosh, yes. I wish we had them sitting right here. Reveal.
I know. So anyway, so I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to call the little gal that signed me up and find out if she's had any experiences with the Board of Equalization, just for kicks. So I called her up and I said, you know, here's the deal. This is kind of what happened. And she goes, oh, I can top that. When she first started, which was just barely a year ago, she had someone from the Board of Equalization show up at one of her events to see what she was doing.
Really? Why?
Well, I mean, that would be the million-dollar question.
Yeah, because it's math. I mean, you sell stuff, it's percentage, mm-hmm. goes back to the...
Yeah.
They want to see if you knew how to do math? Or
don't know.
You were really selling something?
Don't know.
Like you'd pay tax on something that you weren't...
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Aren't you subject to the new rules now where you have to calculate the sales tax for every state or every municipality within a state?
Yeah.
If you sell it to a... Yeah.
And, but, you know, most companies now have that built into their software.
That's what I was going to say. Do you have the software for that?
Well, the company
yeah,
does.
The company
does.
Yeah.
So whenever I order products for myself to resell or for... you know, the customers, I pay the sales tax right off the bat to the company.
So you're just filing a report with what you've already paid. You're not actually holding the sales tax and then sending it in once a quarter. It's already been paid.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an independent contractor. I get a 1099.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, sometimes you pay it after, but you're paying it at.
I pay it when I order the products. The company gets it from me.
So they already got it.
They've already got it.
And they're still bitching about it.
Wow. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
But the fact that somebody actually showed up at one of her events.
And what'd they say?
I don't know. Just, she said it was embarrassing.
Hi, I'm here from the government. I'm here to help.
Yeah, exactly. And then here's another thing I heard. Pretty legitimate source. So, you know how a lot of people will have an LLC?
Sure.
Maybe they don't have it in California, but let's say they have a piece of property. They own a rental house in Alabama, but they want to protect their asset. So they have that piece of property in Alabama registered underneath an LLC. perfectly legitimate. That's a limited liability company, if you don't know what that means, folks. Well, apparently, and I got this from a very legitimate source, the state of California, starting this year, will now be taxing $800 to anybody that has an LLC because they're a resident in California. They're going to assume that because you have a limited liability company in another state, even if you're not doing business, even if it's your summer home that you go visit for 2 weeks in the summer and you just want to have it protected as an asset, they're now going to charge you $800, which is the corporate tax rate in the state of California, because you are a resident of California, and they're just going to go ahead and make a blanket assumption that you're doing business.
More and more and more incentives to live elsewhere, which is, you know, the thing that's always funny to me is if they make it difficult enough and unpleasant enough, people will take their assets and leave.
Yeah, well, they'll just take their marbles and go home.
I know, and then they're not going to have anybody.
Well, okay.
Detroit
is a perfect case in point. They literally, I mean, homes are sitting there that have been on the market for a year and a half. They can't sell them for a dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, people are,
well, it's
are,
a war zone.
People are fleeing Detroit like nobody's business.
I guess they have been. Bill read a book. Maybe you could look it up for us and bring the info in. But a book written in 1989 about Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
that
really?
Far back. Yeah. Wow. And the guy was like, we have a serious problem. And everything he said would happen.
Has happened.
Like, because,
well, it's, I mean, it's just common sense. You can predict. That's why so many people are sitting here right now saying, you know, we're in trouble and it's not getting better and it's not going to, because they're not doing the things they need to do to make it.
No, but it takes a tipping point. Mm-hmm. You know, there have to be enough people who say, we were at an NRA dinner last night, which is kind of part of why we were tardy. Was late.
Yeah.
It was late, and I don't know.
Was that in Shasta County?
It was. It was. It was, in Redding last night.
Oh, shoot. That one slipped by me.
Yeah.
Well,
you can go to Siskiyou County. There's one on September 7th.
Oh, okay.
And that's always good.
That'd be fun.
Last night, I'm not kidding you, the Holiday Inn, every banquet room, like the whole series of them, they were all open. It was all one giant room, and it was stuffed.
Oh, people are, oh, nice.
It was elbow to elbow.
Nice.
Seriously, it was super full. They said it was the best NRA dinner they'd ever had in Redding.
I love that.
Yeah.
That makes me happy.
I know that, you know, raised a lot of money.
Beautiful.
One guy won 5 guns.
Oh,
like,
my God.
What the heck?
Wow, that's so awesome.
But, yeah, it was great.
I was at an event anyway, so.
I should have said something.
Oh,
so
that's okay.
We need to do a little better job of promoting that stuff, but.
Well, clearly, it didn't need it. Sounds like it didn't.
No, actually, yeah, you couldn't get in anyway, so forget it. But, no, it was fun. But there were a lot of people there, and it was amazing to me how many people were just, how are we going to get out of this?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Where is everybody?
Well, it's like, okay, so I'm at Paisano Days yesterday with my damsel in defense, and, boy, you know, the beauty of these types of things is you get to talk to people. And there is not anyone out there that isn't extremely concerned and really over the top about the crime in our area, and especially in the state of California, and the conversations and the people trying desperately to figure out how to leave the state.
Yeah.
My brother
leaves tomorrow, matter of
really?
Fact. Yeah, the moving company comes tomorrow. I think they start loading them up tomorrow. Their stuff ought to be in Texas by the end of the week.
Wow.
So he's going to be like a few minutes away from my brother.
How did I guess it was Texas?
Yeah, well, he's told us a long time ago. It's interesting. My brother moved there like 10 years ago, and my other brother, who lived right around the corner from him, he goes, you know what? As soon as my kids are done with school, as soon as the last one graduates,
we're
out of here. She graduated
in June.
Like, whatever, May or June.
Yeah, he's out of here.
He popped a sign in the yard, and, you know, it's the Bay Area, of course, so you list your house for $700,000, and they pay you $850,000, and then take your cash and walk.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that great?
Not like Detroit.
Yeah.
Not like Detroit where you go, I've got some pocket change. Will you give me your house? I think Bill
I have a dollar. Can I have it?
Well, Bill said there you could get a house for like $7,000.
Wow.
And you look at that.
But nobody would want to. Why would you want to live there?
It's pretty bad when the market is so bad you can't buy a house for, you know, less than you can buy, you know what, a Hyundai?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It goes for $7,000. But
yeah,
it's, I don't know, it's stupid. Extra stupid. So,
And so the veterans issues, update us,
well,
please.
Well, veterans issues, let's see, those are going nicely. They're, you know, we talked about how, you know, we rolled a few people out of the Oakland.
Rolled them to other parts of the country?
A couple of them got, three of them actually wound up in other parts of the country.
Is the big guy still there?
Big guy's still there. But the kind of the problems against him are really mounting and very identifiable. So now there are other people that want. Hey, Bob, your microphone's really on really loud. I was like, why does Bob sound like he's in my ears? So there are a couple of other people who are phoning and want to give information.
And for new listeners, basically, the Veterans Administration out of Oakland, they were giving their employees bonuses if they did not give veterans
their benefits. It was a savings incentive bonus. So the incentive was to save money. The problem is that saving money means
it went into somebody's pocket.
Not paying our veterans.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the whole delay in the claims and da-da-da.
Years and years and years.
And anybody who's got a claim with the Veterans Administration goes, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that has been really productive. But the interesting part of it is that when all of a sudden you make a little headway and people see that, you know, that you have an office, you know, that's serious about getting things done, all of a sudden other people say, well, I've got information.
Yeah.
I've got information.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to go on the record with this. And have you ever looked at this or have you ever looked at that? And it's like,
nice.
Not bad. So, you know, I always remind people.
So the snowball's heading downhill now.
Exactly. And well, actually, and I heard from somebody who has connections in the San Diego and Los Angeles system down there that said, hey, we heard what's going on up in Oakland, and we know some people who might need your number.
Wow.
And then had somebody over at the Reno office, and they said, hey, we heard Ms. Willimon got transferred to Wisconsin. I mean, it's like, you know, so anybody who thinks that the bad bureaucracy out there, you know, there are some people who provide services and they, you know, they do a great job. And the folks, you know, the folks that pipe up and you know, it's like, excuse me, we're being prevented from doing our job.
Mm-hmm.
We think, you know, the veterans deserve their benefits and we're not able to do that and we need help. So there are those folks.
Sure.
Then there are the other ones. Well, there's quite the network.
Oh, nice.
You know, you don't have to fire a lot of shots over the bow. One will do.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you see a lot of movement. So for those folks trapped out there and
never.
I was talking to somebody yesterday who's like 30 years with the Forest Service and just said, oh, my gosh. I mean, what the heck?
Yeah.
But there's always somebody out there who knows the system and who wants to do the right thing. And they usually have friends. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as citizens, we got to remember.
Yeah,
there are people out there doing that. We got to support them
That's right.
Take down the other ones.
Yeah, so you can't really make blanket accusations about bureaucratic employees because
generalizations don't always cut it. But there are always good people in there,
yeah.
and so it's nice. And that's what you know. That's what we think we have to think about when we look at all these things like Detroit and, you know, California and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go like that forever.
Mm-hmm.
It only goes like that to a point, and then pretty soon enough people step up and say, okay, enough's enough.
Yeah.
We're throwing you out. Like, look at, you know, Bell, California.
Yeah.
You know, all right, we've had it.
Yeah.
Or the guys on the inside finally go, okay,
well, look
we
at,
can't take it.
Look at, was it the 16th, the area down by Tulare, Andy Vidak?
Uh-huh.
You know, here's a farmer who went up against a liberal Latino opponent in a heavily Latino community, and he won.
Ding, 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 ding. People are like, okay, we think actually you might be able to manage money and make decisions.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing.
Well, he ran a great campaign, apparently. He got out and connected with those people and talked to them about jobs and things that they were actually concerned about.
Imagine that. Well, and there were a lot of people. I know that there's a whole contingent of 20-somethings from Chico State and a bunch of other places that went down and walked precincts.
And that just brings me to another topic. Believe it or not, young people do know what's going on. I don't know about the 30-somethings, but the 20-somethings really get it because we're really starting to draw them into our tea parties now. They're starting to become regular attendees, and they're taking leadership roles within the tea parties locally. And they will be the first ones to tell you that they know what's going on, and so do their friends. And I mean, I was in a restaurant a month ago, had a great conversation with this beautiful young lady who was probably 26, 27 years old, and I mean, she knew everything, and she assured me that all of her friends did too.
And they are dealing more and more,
and they're dealing with it in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
See, they may not gravitate toward what we're doing, but you can't expect them to. We're a different generation. We have different skill sets, but they are doing it in their own way.
I hear,
because it's their future that is totally at risk.
Uh-huh. And people want to see them all in a room together. Why aren't they all in a room together? It just isn't going to work that way.
No, you've got to let them do it their own way. But trust me, they know.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
So,
so a lot going on out there.
I don't know if we're talking about mining today, ultimately, here in a minute. Probably have to do a swift break and then bring Kirby on. I had a nice chat with him yesterday. You know, and I thought the title was pretty fun, the title of the program. If you go to wethepeopleradio.us, you can pull quite a bit of information about our guest, actually, and a couple of books that he's written. His name's Kirby Jackson, and Robert called it some big minor problems.
Nice. And just jump on wethepeopleradio.us. We are chatting and streaming worldwide.
Okay, we're getting calls this morning, one of them from our good friend Charles, and I had another gentleman just call. They want to make sure we get the word out about the Air Quality Pollution Board meeting on Tuesday morning here in Shasta County.
8:30
on Tuesday morning at the Board of Supervisors.
That's on Court Street.
Chambers, where you'll have an opportunity to make public comments on geoengineering and that sort of thing.
Yeah, because we've got a lot of restrictions for things that are aren't doing anything. I mean, things that aren't really causing a problem. Well, the things that are causing a problem are being ignored.
Air Pollution Control District is what it is, APCD.
Okay,
lovely.
Very good, Bob. Nice. That rolled right off your tongue.
Very good. And City Council, Reading City Council is going to be a hot one tomorrow.
Tuesday night.
Yeah, I was reading all about it. It was in the paper. The phone's ringing off the hook. I guess I shouldn't ask him a question while he's picking up the phone, huh?
Probably not. He's good, but he's not that good.
He can only use his lips in one direction. Okay, so let's go back to Kirby. Let's go back to that. He's an author. He's an independent gold miner. And he's a historian living in Southern Oregon's Rogue River Valley, an area where Zane Grey and Jack London often came to receive inspiration to write their own novels. In addition to being a multi-generational native of the Rogue River Valley, father's family have been on the North American continent since the 1600s. So he's like the boss of us. Hey, check out the folks he's related to. It's just kind of random information here. He's a direct descendant of Sir Thomas More, who was a lawyer, philosopher, statesman, and the author of Utopia, who was beheaded for treason against Henry VIII in 1535.
Wow.
Okay, I don't have any relatives that were beheaded, although they were Vikings, so I think they probably did anyway.
Wow.
And of Martha Allen Carrier, supposedly she was a witch. She was referred to by Cotton Mather in the Queen of Hell, and she was hanged during the Salem witch trials during 1692.
Oh, my God.
they had a tough road to hoe there. Family album.
I guess our listeners are taking your advice and not waiting until the last 10 minutes of the hour to call in.
I subliminally notified them that if they call it 2 minutes to the hour, we're going to ignore them. That's funny. Okay, what was that about?
That one was to wish the Coast Guard a happy birthday, happy anniversary today.
Seriously?
I did not know that. That's fine. Wow. Hey, thanks a lot.
Wow.
I would hum the song. Do I know the song? I have a cousin who is a captain of a ship in the Coast Guard.
And, you know, we forget that the
Bob Belongi is in the Coast Guard.
Well, there you go.
We forget that the Coast Guard is actually part of our military, really.
I think sometimes people forget.
Yeah.
They go the big four and then they blow the other guys off. That's wrong.
Isn't that great? It's like the National Guard.
When we lived in Connecticut, my cousin, he would bring, you know, we were, junior high school, and the guys would come from the Coast Guard Academy, and they'd wear, like, all their, you know, their white dress uniforms and stuff. And, of course, you know, a bunch of teenage girls. My friends are like, is your cousin going to be over again? We were the closest relatives. He lived in Washington State, so he used to hang at our house. It was fun. That's the broad base of information I have about the Coast Guard. Sorry. They have great uniforms. But no, my cousin made a career out of it. He, I would imagine he might have retired by now, but he commanded a ship in Alaska and then in Hawaii. I thought, wow, two major extremes. So, yeah, I know. It's like, okay, I'm done with Alaska. How about Hawaii?
Kirby is taking all of this in.
Nice. Well, we were talking about Kirby's relatives who've had a very, very colorful past. What do we need to do here?
Long overdue for a break.
We're drifting aimlessly in space this morning. God, in so many ways. All right. Swift break, and we'll be right back with you. We're going to be talking about mining. So for those of you that think mining is just something from the past, I've got news for you.
So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you've played before, California's a brand new game.
Welcome back.
We already talked about that, though.
We always sing along to that song. Yeah, California.
I like about how it's in a bank with somebody else's name.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, California is definitely unique and not always in a good way. I mean, parts of it are, but lately we're not infamous for our beautiful mountains and beaches.
Exactly. So, so the chaos is over now. Are we done with the chaos? I feel pretty good about that. I think we've handled chaos. And
we put the chaos on hold.
This is like Get Smart. Chaos overtook us. And so we have our guest, Kirby Jackson. We've had him hostage, I believe, inside the phone system. And Kirby, we talked about your relatives, but we didn't really talk about how you got into mining and the things that are relevant to the program, although your family history is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it goes back a long way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up back there, so the Salem witch trials were all part of, you know, we went to all those places, went to Salem and studied all that stuff, and wow.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've never actually been back there.
Oh, it's cool.
So
it's cool, and they don't throw anything away or pave over anything,
they don't.
Take your time, it'll all still be there. It's not like out here where, you know, it's built for 5 years, we're bored with it, we mow it down and put a shopping mall on it.
Well, we used to not do that here either, though.
Up where you are, they're a little more respectful of that.
Well, that's changing. You know, we're kind of more like the extension of Northern California now up here. So, you know, it has.
We're
changed.
Sorry. He's like, so am I. Well, you have Ashland. You kind of got Ashland leading the way.
Yeah. We'd like for you guys to take that back, please.
Yeah, we've already got a lot of Ashland down here. Oh, my gosh. Well, so you grew up there in Oregon. So were you into mining as a kid and all that kind of thing?
My interest started pretty young. I was, you know, my grandmother was a miner, and she was the first generation of my father's family to come from the East. She's the one that goes back to Martha Carrier and Thomas More. And the rest of it, unfortunately, kind of makes a bad combination. When you have those people in your ancestry, you become a rebel rouser, and you're a little bit different from most people, you know, kind of a hard-headed bunch. And needless to say, when she was a girl, her family was actually pretty well-to-do, and when she got older, she wanted to strike out on her own, and she decided to come out here, and I think she had some preconceived notions about the way things were, and I think she thought it was the Wild West still. And she came out here, and she decided she really wanted to live in the hills and live off the land. My grandmother was kind of a different sort of person, and needless to say, she was actually a female miner, after the Great Depression, was actually kind of living out there in the brush before my father was born and making our living mining and, you know, kind of living off the land for a long time. So that's actually where my interest comes from. My great-grandfather on my mother's side, he was actually a copper miner. He was an immigrant, and he was college-educated, and he had come over from Europe and decided to come out west, and he ended up in Montana, and eventually he ended up here, and they kind of all eventually met. And then I came along. So needless to say, as a kid, I had a real strong interest early on and did know quite a bit about mining. Strangely enough, I didn't get my start in mining until at about age 5 or 6, we actually moved to western Idaho. And I actually did my first mining over there as a kid with a gold pan, and we went to a lot of different ghost towns and things of that nature. Needless to say, I really got a real sense of history, and that's really what drives me in this.
That's cool, because, you know, and for all the people that think that mining is either giant corporations...
or some little hobby.
Or something you do on the weekend with a little gold pan. There's a whole range in the middle.
There is.
And that, well, the big range in the middle is really what's under attack. And so all the suction dredge mining has been very much in... I'm going to say in the news because it's been in our local papers periodically just because of the regulation, but they don't explain it very well, and a lot of what they tell people is inaccurate.
Yeah, it is. I have read articles that have been in, like, the Reading Searchlight and different newspapers, internet sites, and kind of what you get when it's in the media, it's actually a retelling of the same theme. They actually even use the same terminology over again, especially when they refer to suction dredging. They refer to machines driven by diesel engines, which now they've kind of went away from that, and they've referred to the gold as little tiny specks of gold, and they keep using the same terms over and over, and it's actually kind of a meme they use that's, you know, really, in our opinion as miners, it's actually really meant to detract from mining and kind of push an agenda forward that's usually anti-mining.
Sure, and it's easy to kind of shuffle you guys off to Buffalo, like we were chatting about yesterday. The houndsmen, you know, as far as hunting goes, the houndsmen are a fairly small group, so it was easy to marginalize them.
Right.
And oh, you know, look, those dogs must be suffering, and oh, the bears, you know, and it's not really hunting, and they just didn't put any fact out there about it, but people didn't know.
Right.
So
exactly,
it wasn't that people supported the legislation, they just didn't oppose it, which is like supporting it.
Yeah, and we do end up with the same thing where you do get a marginalization in front of the public, that you get the portrayal that a lot of these guys who are out there mining, especially during the summer with their suction dredges, that they're hobbyists. And for those who've ever actually done any mining, even if you're really not making any money at this, it's not a hobby. You're doing an awful lot of work for something that's supposed to be a hobby. And I've never met a miner, even if it's, you know, a younger kid with a gold pan who's not out there trying to, you know, find the gold and, you know, put some money in his pocket.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the idea that it's a hobby or recreation while we all enjoy mining, it's a fairly frustrating thing. It requires an investment. It requires work. And needless to say, you hope there's a reward at the end. And that's really one of the things I'd like to get across, is that it's usually, in most cases, mining is mining.
Sure.
You know, unless it's the family going out with their gold pan, you know, once during their summer vacation to try it out.
Well, of all the things, you know, I guess it's kind of hard to quantify. Okay, you can give me a few. Of all the stuff that they say about mining, I mean, what are the really just gross inaccuracies?
That would be a long list.
I know. I was like, I think I'm asking.
Well, and the environmental agencies primarily go after natural resources for things that end up in streams, which most of the time is dirt, because I guess you don't have dirt in streams. And that's
evil,
always been
evil dirt. We all know that's poisonous.
That's like one of the craziest things that I've ever heard
of.
Yeah,
there's dirt in the water. Uh-oh.
So is that one of them?
That is one of them. And kind of what it all is summed up as is there is an idea put forward that when the miner goes out there, he's adding pollution mm-hmm. to the stream. And we actually don't do that. We don't add anything to the water. You know, we have, regardless of how you do it, if you're using a gold pan or a little sluice box or a suction dredge, or even you're going a little bigger with a bulldozer and an excavator, you're still using the same basic methodology, only on a much bigger or smaller scale. And what you're adding to water at the worst of times is dirt, which was already there.
Well, exactly.
You know, so
sure.
Needless to say, whatever was there, that's what comes out.
Well, you know, and this is not off topic, but the thing that just cracks me up and right now is that we have these environmental agencies and representatives of some of the bureaucracies that have no problem going out and harassing timberland owners and loggers and miners and farmers and ranchers, but they're scared to death of the pot growers. Now, the pot growers are doing bad, devastating things to our environment.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
These guys won't harass them.
What I've actually noticed with, you know, I've had a lot of interaction with the agencies, sometimes good, oftentimes bad. You know, I've had to solve an awful lot of miners' problems in the past. And one thing I have noticed is the two federal agencies, BLM and the Forest Service, they are terrified of the pot growers. And I mean terrified. I mean, they will not, if they think there's the possibility, there may not even be any evidence of any being, you know, in a given area. They have literally reached the point. I had a conversation with a guy from BLM, and we were kind of doing some things we weren't supposed to do. We were pushing on this illegal mineral withdrawal down here on the Rogue River. So we were out in the river, and they really don't like us out in the river. And this BLM guy walks up, and he says, I've never seen anything like this. You know, we had four dredges out there. And I said, well, don't you go up these creeks? And he says, no, we don't go up those. We're not allowed to go up there. And it's like, why? And he says, well, there's pot growers all over the place.
Wow.
And it seems like the two agencies, and this is one of their law enforcement guys, they are absolutely terrified.
They just pick on people that, I mean, they're picking on the innocent.
Right.
You know, it's that schoolyard bully thing. You know, go pick on somebody your own size.
Well, if you find a landowner,
mm-hmm.
It's a lot easier to collect from them.
Sure.
Absolutely.
You know, you find a pot grower who, you know, maybe running
might
a cart.
They might fight back.
Running a cartel out of a foreign country, they mm-hmm. just disappear. And mm-hmm. so you can ring their bell all day long, but it's dangerous, and then they disappear. Hey, Kirby, as far as the, I mean, there's so many different aspects of this. It's a property right, so it crosses over on property rights.
Right.
We ought to get to that part. We talked about the suction dredging, but, you know, describe for people what that means. For people who've never seen that or might live in a place where this just isn't done.
Basically what a suction dredge is, and it can take an awful lot of forms, and you'll find that miners as a whole, because we've learned the way it works, a lot of us don't even use that term anymore. And it's actually, if you...
What are we supposed to call it?
What they're calling them now in different areas, will refer to them as suction devices, underwater vacuums.
Well, that's a good name, because that is what they are.
Vacuum rummagers, gravity transfer systems. And basically what the premise is, and the reason we don't use the term suction dredge, is that's actually something in particular. A suction dredge was actually what was originally called a suction augmentation dredge. And those were invented back around the turn of the century, the last century, 1905, 1906. And those are big, huge machines. You know, they're similar to bucket line dredges or cutter dredges that they use to reclimate harbors. And we don't do that. That's what the Army Corps of Engineers does when they go out and they clean these rivers and harbors up. That's what they use is a dredge. And they did use dredges for mining, but we're talking about a thing that's the size of a two- or three-story house on the small scale.
Wow.
So what we actually use is we usually use a machine that it usually floats. It's got two floats similar to, say, two kayaks put together. It's about the size of the floats, a little thinner. A frame, and then you have basically an engine that is comparable to what's on the average person's lawnmower, and that has a pump on it, and that creates a form of suction when you get a Venturi effect. So needless to say, you basically have the equivalent of an underwater vacuum. And so you suck the material off the bottom of the waterway, and it goes through a sluice box or some other methodology, and that separates whatever's there. So we use gravity separation, usually using a sluice box. And this is all general. We all do things different. And basically what you have with this gravity separation is anything that's heavier than the light material drops into the riffles of the sluice box. So that catches your gold, it catches lead, mercury, broken glass, nails, pieces of junk, jewelry, whatever's in the water that's heavier than the basic material that's in there. And that, and that's kind of it in a nutshell. Is that, that's kind of what we do as a whole. That's it in a, the simplest terms I can put forward.
So it isn't like people are, you know, because I think sometimes the way they paint this is that you guys are taking all the material in the riverbed and taking it someplace else. You're basically just sorting through it.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually why, kind of why the term vacuum rummaging came into vogue among miners, is because that's kind of what it is you're down there underwater and you're sucking this stuff up, and literally you're kind of rummaging for just the heavy stuff, and the light stuff, it's moving about 10 feet behind you. So you're actually kind of picking up the stream bed and just shifting it a ways.
So as far as, you know, because, you know, always we have to be, you know, freaking out about fish, but from a fish standpoint, I would imagine this stirs up a lot of things that they might want to eat.
It actually does, and there are a lot of photos. People can go on the internet, they can find them, they can look for, you know, if you go out and you Google fish in suction dredge hole or something to that effect. What we've found, and we've been doing suction mining, it's not a new thing. This the first guys, a lot of this actually started in Southwest Oregon, Northern California, back in the late 60s. Those were the first guys that were building these contraptions in their garages. You know, and basically what they did was they looked back to old technology, and basically they were kind of making their own versions. And these early miners, they were real inventive guys, so they were always tinkering and doing this and doing that. But the fish, what we've found over the years, over the last almost 50 years of doing this, is that the fish are gravitated toward it. And it is because you are stirring up some sediment. You're basically releasing food behind you. And I've talked to an awful lot of fishermen that they'll say, hey, would you please put your dredge in the water over there, and I'm going to cast my line about 10 feet behind you. You know, because they know the fish gravitate toward it. And I've literally, mining in the past, I've been in the water where you will literally have hundreds of fish around you, ranging from little tiny minnows on up to large salmon.
Wow. So the thing on the Riverkeepers website about the big win for Oregon salmon and the clean water they depend on, I mean, they have this bizarre, you know, fixation that the water has to have nothing in it. What do they think fish eat?
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and the thing is, as miners, especially here in Oregon, we've already been through this. We went through this in the 30s, long before I was born. You know, before my parents were born, but, you know, basically back in my grandmother's time, she was born right before the Depression, and the miners up here, they went through this. They were still hydraulic mining at that time, and there was actually research done at that time that there was concern about the fish, you know, because obviously the Rogue River in particular, there's a lot of sport fishing takes place, and there were large hydraulic mines dotting up and down the river, especially around Galice, and there was concern about it. Does this impact the fish? And the state of Oregon actually ordered at that time, because there was a court case around it, and that was referred to as the Galice Mud Mining War is what it was called officially. So the state actually ordered research being done, and they got an individual by the name of Philip Ward, who at that time, he was probably the preeminent fish biologist of his day. And what he found was, he actually found that sediment in the river is actually beneficial to fish.
You know,
it
Surprise.
Cools the water, it creates shade, it provides cover for smaller fish from their predators. And he did quite a bit of research, and the environmentalists, they don't like to talk about this study, and their usual reaction to it is when it's brought up as, well, we don't want studies done by somebody who was born during the Civil War. You know, and that's their response to it.
Wow.
And they think they can stuff went off. And keep in mind, we're not talking about doing research based on, you know, the effects of suction dredging. We're talking about hydraulic mining.
Sure. Well, because it's funny. One of the links when I did the little search you sent me on here sent me to the stupid river keepers, and I've dealt with them before. So it's like, oh, I wonder what those knuckleheads are saying. Yeah, miners also move and relocate cobbles and small boulders to access finer sediment, and thereby changing the channel bed and the aquatic habitat. I can see you guys out there lifting giant boulders and relocating streams by hand. That's fantastic. You guys must be really strong, too.
Don't you get the impression?
Well, I mean, you know, I always thought that, you know, our forerunners did amazing feats, but we must do really amazing
feats. No, you guys are incredible, yeah.
These agencies are so melodramatic.
Well, this is an environmental group.
These environmental groups are so melodramatic.
These are,
you know, and,
these are,
and there is a certain amount of stream material that is moved, and we can move boulders. You know, we do have that capability if you're underwater. The material, basically, because you're in the water, it is actually lighter in relation to what it normally
would
be.
Yeah, but you're not going
to say a boulder that weighs a ton. It weighs significantly less in the water. And if you have a come along in a bar, yeah, you can move it.
But you're not relocating a whole river. I mean, they make it sound like, you know, one guy in there. It's just funny. You read some of this stuff, and
you know, the average guy who's out there mining during the summer, you know, up here in Oregon, we're actually almost into mid-season now. We're actually headed toward the last month. So miners have been working for, basically, the guys who are out there every day, they've been working basically for about 20 days now. The guys on the Klamath River the same way, the guys who are still mining who found the loophole. And even the guys who I know are, you know, and these are guys I know personally, they're very hard-working guys. They're out there every day. They're in the water 8 to 10 hours a day. I mean, they're busting their butts, you know, trying to make a living. Even those guys, the large amount of river they've moved, they've got maybe a hole that's maybe 25 to 30 feet wide. And that's it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a lot of work. You know, it takes a lot, you know, you can only put so much of the river up that, you know, 4-inch suction tube.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. We're going to take a really quick break or we'll be jammed against the news here. We are talking with Kirby here about mining. We're going to be right back with you in a couple of minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Check us out online, wethepeopleradio.us, here at KCNR, 1460 AM.
And we're back.
Bob,
we're talking all things.
Boston was as close as I could get to Salem.
Oh, there you go.
Good one.
We're talking about mining and all of the delusions on the part of the agencies and environmental groups.
We get to talk about the legal part next hour, actually. There's a lot of legal stuff that's been happening that I think people might be unaware of that actually impacts all of us because it's property rights.
Yeah.
So, Kirby, why don't we do this? We've got a few minutes here before the top of the hour. Why don't you give people a little sketch on what we're going to do next hour?
What are we talking about next hour?
You know, because whatever pops into your head.
The legalese of it?
Yeah, go ahead and freeform it.
kind of it in a nutshell is what a lot of people do, and this is one of the things we've really been trying to get across to people, and it's difficult. That, you know, we've done a lot of political activities as far as really trying to get the word out about this, and it's actually pretty difficult because the media, they're definitely on the side of the environmentalists as a general rule, so it's actually been pretty hard for us to kind of really get our point across about certain things. And one of the things we really want to stress to people is, in this country, from the standpoint of mining, we're actually in a fairly unique position in this country. In most countries in the world, and I've lived overseas, I spent a few years in the U.K., and I was actually on the radio yesterday with a fellow from South Africa who's got an interest in mining. And what's really unique about the United States is that in the United States, the minerals actually belong to the people, as a general rule. And basically what happened was back during the gold rush, we had this mass of people came from the east, and they came here out west, and there were all these minerals out here. You know, and you had the famous gold strike down there at Sutter's Mill, down there by Coloma in California, you know, down there on the Sacramento River. And that wasn't the first gold discovery in California, but that's really what attracted people. That was the first one that was promoted, and they said, oh, there's gold in California. So there was this mass of people came out here looking for minerals, especially gold. And at the time, the government's viewpoint was these people were just going out, and they're actually on the government's land, and they're taking all these minerals. And there's kind of a little bit of history that a lot of people don't know about. This almost started, especially during the 1860s, when there were high tensions due to the Civil War and issues in the South and issues in the North and issues out here. This almost started a Civil War as a result of this, and a lot of people don't know this. There was kind of a perception in the Far East that the first settlers who were out here on the Far West, that they were kind of squatting out here in government land, and they were using the resources, and especially they were basically putting the gold in their pockets. And this really became a hot-button issue that, from the standpoint of history, and you won't find it in the school textbook, but there was actually foreign troops shocked. Mounted on the border of California and the border of Oregon Territory at the time. You know, or actually it was Washington Territory, I take that back. And basically because there was this perception in the Far East that this was basically belonged to the government. And the miners at the time, this first generation, so these are our forerunners, you know, if you're a native California or a native Oregonian or you're a native of Nevada, these were probably your ancestors.
Nice. We're coming
and
back.
And basically they were out there, they were extracting the gold and the silver and the other minerals. So there was this mentality in some parts of Congress that this was government property and that people shouldn't be doing this.
Hey, Kirby, hold that thought, or Fox News is going to start talking right over the top of you. Okay. We're going to be back in 5 minutes. We're talking about mining next hour. If you want to call in, do it early, 530-605-4567.
More of Kirby on We the People on KCNR Shasta Redding.
Fastest 5 minutes in the West.
What is up with that?
We are back with... I know, it seemed like it was 30 seconds.
It used to take a long time.
Yeah. We the People Radio. You are joining your hosts, Aaron Ryan, Elizabeth Woodward, and Bob Martin. We're talking about mining, all of the travesties of all of our natural resources and activities therein. And
property rights.
And environmental activists and crazy bureaucracies.
So I was reminded, I reminded myself on the break of a story from the NRA dinner last night.
This was funny.
Okay, so we sat there with some people we didn't know, and there were these three ladies who all worked together, or two ladies that all worked together, and the lady's husband. So they went with one of their coworkers. So three women, they're in San Francisco, and they're there for some training thing for their work. And the bus dropped them off at night to their hotel, but missed their stop. So they were several blocks off. And they were in, I guess, some ratty neighborhood. So anyway, they're walking down the street. One of the women has a purse across her body. Instead of over the shoulder, it was across her.
That's how I always wear mine.
So these three guys jump out of the bushes and grab this lady's purse, and they're literally dragging her down the sidewalk because the purse didn't come off right away. And so the other gal, she carries a gun. So she pulls her gun out of her purse, I guess, and I guess they're under a street light. And so the glint was huge. The other woman, the third woman, didn't know she carried a gun. She screams, "She's got a gun!" And so I guess these three criminals freaked out and ran away.
Yeah.
And she was like, "Huh. Put your gun back in your purse." They went off to the hotel. Everybody lived happily ever after.
That's awesome.
I was laughing.
See, sometimes all you need is a deterrent.
Yeah, it didn't involve any shooting. Yeah. There was nothing involved. It was just, my gun's bigger than your ability to drag my friend down the street.
Right.
So,
apparently it was a big gun, too.
Everybody made out. So it was pretty
nice.
Fun. So just in case you were thinking that there's no point in carrying a gun because you don't want to shoot anybody.
Yeah, I don't know. Always have to.
Yeah, apparently you don't don't always have to. I actually had a dream about it last night. You know, it planted the seed. So I woke up this morning, you know, and yeah, I was involved mm-hmm. in gunplay and all that. And I thought, oh, boy, I'm so suggestible. So I'm sure tomorrow morning I'll be dreaming about mining.
Yeah.
So back to our guest, Kirby Jackson, who is a miner up in Oregon. And got a colorful family history. I would encourage you to go to wethepeopleradio.us and read the story.
And don't forget, fun. We're chatting and streaming worldwide. Chat room's always interesting.
Oh, yeah. And you can send the show to people afterwards. But there are a couple of books. Kirby's written a couple of books. And, Kirby, I got to know, where'd you find the picture for the Golden Trail, More Stories of Oregon's Mining Years? There is a great picture on the cover.
The image from the Golden Trail, even though my book's actually about Oregon, that's actually from the Black Hills. And it's actually was actually made by a government photographer with the U.S. Geological Survey during the Black Hills Gold Rush, and it's from 1899. And the title of the photo is "We've Struck It Rich," and they're a bunch of happy guys if you see the looks on their face.
Oh yeah, but it's just like a classic. It's just a classic photo from the West,
and that's a really famous photo. And like I said, even though it's actually from South Dakota, I like that photo enough. I decided to go ahead and use it.
Oh my gosh, it's perfect. It's just perfect. And then Gold Dust, the Oregon mining historian and prospector Kirby Jackson brings you a treasure trove of 17 stories on Southern Oregon's rich history of gold prospecting. I just thought is that what's on the back of the book? Or
yeah, that's from the back of the book.
Yeah, the breathtaking areas they settled and made homes. And that's the thing. I guess that's why mining just... That's why the assault on mining bugs me so much, mm-hmm. is it's such a piece of our history that continues, and continues very much in the background. Do you have any idea how many people actually make their living with mining that aren't with a big company, that are just independent people out there?
Yeah, what are some of the ancillary businesses that are a result of mining?
Well, there's
tons. Kind of the only thing I really have track of, that I kind of have my finger on the pulse of, is actually here in Josephine County, here in Southwest Oregon. And from what we know in the mining organizations, in Josephine County at last count, we had about 500 miners who were, these guys are residents of this area.
That's a lot, because you're not in a very populated area.
This is really before
area,
the price of gold went up. So actually that number is growing. There's especially a lot of younger guys who are now in their 30s, early 40s. They have kids. Sometimes their wife helps them, and they're supplementing their income by mining. So, the other thing that they support is we do have a large number of miners who do come into this area from out of state, and they do come here and they mine during the summer. They own claims here, so they're property owners here. You know, even though it's a unique form of property, it's a little different from your house, but it's still a type of property. And there's usually about 30 or 40 of those guys. They come in this area, Josephine, Jackson County, that we know of. And needless to say, all of us, you know, we are dependent on fuel and food and things of that nature, and basically the different things we need, and obviously on the mining shops, various
sure.
equipment shops. You know, we, as miners, we need a lot of stuff. You know, the primary thing we need is we need fuel, we need equipment, and we need, obviously, food. You know, so there's an awful, like Bear Gold Hill, where they're doing an awful lot of mining right now in the river with the suction dredges. You know, those guys, they're going back and forth every day to Gold Hill, and they're using the gas station and the convenience store, so they're going after fuel. And on average, we're probably each spending $20 to $25 a day on fuel, you know, however much on food, you know, this and that. So needless to say, it really does impact more, you know, there's a lot of the environmentalists say, well, it's just the mining shops getting rich. And it's really not the... RV parks there around Gold Hill. They are really dependent on the miners. They've actually got kind of a whole crew of guys. They come back every year, and that guy there, he is really dependent on their business to keep going. I know in there was a restraining order that some of the businesses there in Siskiyou County actually filed against California DFG over closing that loophole, but there were actually more local businesses that really, on the surface, didn't have anything to do with mining, that were actually plaintiffs in that. And it was gas stations and food stores and this and that, that basically these were individuals that their businesses, they felt it was, you know, that basically the miners there coming in every summer was very important to their business. So it actually is fairly far-reaching. You know, we do need a lot of different things.
Well, and the property, how does the property right work? Like if somebody wanted to go and become a minor? How would you even, besides the fact you should know something about it?
I was talking earlier about how that got started, and like I said, in the 1860s, things were very stressful at that time. And there was a debate went on in Congress, and basically the core of the debate was, do these minerals belong to the government or do they belong to the people? And ultimately, as a result of the debate and a lot of hard effort on the people who were responsible to do it, it was mainly William Stewart, who was a senator out of Nevada, and he had actually come up in the gold fields there on the Sacramento River. Eventually, the minerals, it was decided that especially California would basically recognize what the miners had already been doing. The miners were out there mining, they were building towns, basically settling the land, and the official policy of the government became that, you know, minerals would be in private ownership. And this is unique. There was actually on the Senate floor, this was actually a representative from Indiana by the name of George Julian. He was actually against this, and he said that on the Senate floor, he said this legislation would revolutionize the public lands of the country and actually surrender to the people, for the first time in history, all the mineral wealth of the Far West to the people. And he thought that was a terrible thing. So needless to say, today, what the system that was created was, if you are a citizen of the United States or you are an immigrant and you've declared your intention to become one, you have a right to go out on what's called the public domain, and there's a difference between public land and public domain.
Ruh-roh. That was a bad sound.
Did we lose it?
How about his line abruptly disconnected? I will try to get him back momentarily.
Darn NSA, they hate miners.
I was just going to say, which acronym agency was that?
Exactly. Uh-oh. That made a strange sound, too.
Oh, that was just me making strange sounds with my buttons and switches over here. I think he's gone, but we'll get him back momentarily.
Okay, well, a couple things that we, the few people on the mic on the chat room, who is also a miner, he had brought up that the government doesn't like gold mining because it's a cash business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, you don't think about that. They can't be running out there auditing them in the stream beds.
Sure.
And it's very difficult to close down, you know, they want to close down the forest roads and all that. It's very difficult to close down our quote-unquote wild areas, you know. They can't turn them into wilderness areas. They've got these darn miners with rights in there.
Yeah.
You know, that's a huge problem.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how many facets of this intersect with things that we already know are a problem. But the cash business part kind of goes...
Never thought about that.
I didn't either. And, yeah. I was laughing because I'm thinking about you know, with your stun guns and all that, you know. And here you've got the Board of Equalization. What are you doing with the stun guns?
I know. Isn't that
what do they
funny?
Care? Hey, you could sell... Well, look at the guy who sold pet rocks.
Pet rocks.
Don't you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
The pet rock craze?
I do.
Yeah, over on the coast where they had... tons of material that always flew down the mountains and hit you when you were driving on Highway 101.
Right.
They used to take them and put them in these, they were like a heavy weight, but it looked like a chicken wire box almost. Mm-hmm. And it was filled with rocks. And they used to put signs on them that said Pet Rock Prison. I'm sure they audited that guy.
Oh,
what are you doing with the rocks? You with the rocks.
Yeah. So, I like the voice, by the way.
Do you like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my Willimon voice.
Yeah. Reminds me, did you ever see the Adam Sandler? Oh, 51st Dates. You know, did you ever see 51st Dates with Adam Sandler?
Oh, yeah.
Hilarious movie. And the gal that liked the walrus or walrus threw up on her or something.
Yeah,
you remember that character? You sound just like her. Just so you know.
It's me, the evil Villamon from the Veterans Administration. She is gone now. She's kind of like a Natasha, and then, you know.
I can hear everybody laughing out there.
Well, when Mark and I hosted the Friday Morning Drive Show, you know, we decided, hey, we should do a show one time and just do it all with voices.
Yeah.
We should just take on different personas.
Man. He's got his,
so Bob's
too.
Over there chatting with Kirby. What the heck? What
not
are you guys
Kirby.
Doing? You have a man world
not,
over there?
Not Kirby. It's Mike Adams.
Oh, you're talking to Mike Adams.
Kirby's MIA? Apparently still on his line thinking he's on the air when he's not, so I'm trying to leave him a message to tell him to clear his lines. But Mike joins us
Nice. Well, we better take
meantime.
We better take a really quick break, though. Oh, we can't because you're. Oh, we can. I'm looking at your computer and it's a blank screen. But we better take a really quick break, otherwise we'll be behind on everything. So we need to thank our advertisers, and God love them. You know what? The world goes around because of advertisers. We thank them. Here at KCNR, 1460 AM, we'll be right back with you.
Back on Gold Dust Woman, take your silver spoon, take your bread.
And we're back.
Another song with the word gold in it. There are a lot. A lot of songs with the word gold in it.
There are a lot of those songs out there.
Didn't see that Fleetwood Mac one coming, though.
Goldust Woman.
Nice job, Bob.
That was Sting's Fields of Gold there, by the way. Mm-hmm.
Nice. All right, so we've got Mike Adams.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike. Hostage in our phone here.
Yes, I do.
Uncle Mike, what's going on?
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about the cash problem with gold, okay? Now, according to the IRS, gold, as we take it out of the river, is just a yellow rock. Until such time as you smelt it down or fashion it into a piece of jewelry, in other words, put a bale on it so you can make a necklace out of it, once you do that, it then becomes income. But as we take it out of the river, the gold nuggets and gold dust are just yellow rocks, and it's not taxable under the IRS rules. Of course, most of us sell our gold. We sell it to buyers. They pay us cash. There are no receipts. Nobody says who they bought it from or how much they paid for it. So it's truly a cash business and therefore under the government radar. Now, the state of California doesn't like that. The state of Oregon doesn't like that. And the feds don't like that. And so we do have a fundamental problem there.
Interesting. That does, and that puts the target, you know, squarely on you.
Well, you know, when you start talking about being a sovereign citizen, how much more sovereign can you be?
Yeah, that's true. You know, they're not actually in Seattle. I don't know if you guys caught that, but last week there was a big blowout in the news about how, I don't even know who it was, somebody used the word citizen. And they're not going to use that anymore in Seattle. Seattle, you can't call people citizens because that's demeaning.
Oh,
it's demeaning for demeaning for the other people
who aren't.
Citizen is not politically correct, and they can no longer use the term brown bag.
Oh yeah, I read that.
Yep, that's down too. So I'm sure sovereign.
Can you use white bag?
So, well, you just can't. Bag is bad too.
See? Bag is bad.
So what do you use?
You just don't.
Lunch pails?
We're gonna all learn sign language.
There's another bag expression that comes to mind, but I won't repeat it here.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was somehow that one was okay.
Yeah, that was all right.
Yeah, bad is good. Yeah, he's so bad.
Yeah. Well, it's like my nephew, you know, he kept saying, "That's dope." That's dope. I'm like, huh. Interesting. Yeah.
The other thing about this loophole that supposedly was shut down in Santa Barbara, our gravel transfer system, a lot of us have some questions about this. When Judge Dixon gave us the temporary moratorium on the emergency closure from the Fish and Game, she only gave it to Siskiyou County because that is the limit of her jurisdiction. She is a circuit court judge and could not do it throughout the whole state. She can only do it within her jurisdiction, which was Siskiyou County. So then Fish and Game goes down to Santa Barbara, goes to another circuit court judge, and she overturns it, except it's not in her jurisdiction. So we're all kind of going, what? So we don't think that this little loophole has been shut down yet, not until they take it to a higher court.
Well, good. Kirby?
That is my understanding on that. I have talked to a miner out of Happy Camp that is pretty closely connected to New 49ers, who obviously they were the ones who were, you know, largely responsible for putting together the restraining order there in Siskiyou County. And it actually sounds like, from what I'm being told, at least, and obviously where I'm up here in Oregon, I'm not privy to some of the same information they have in Northern California, even though there's, you know, like 30 air miles divide us. You just have to go over the hills, you know, and drive the long way around. But kind of my understanding is that the environmentalists, they had this case down there in San Bernardino, and when they issued a press release, they said, oh, this closes the loophole. And I think a lot of miners just went, well, okay, I'll go back up to Oregon. And now most of them are up here going, wait a minute, what's going on? I guess we can be back down there. So I think they're all kind of headed down there again. So there are guys on the down there in Siskiyou County still mining, and from what I've been told, there's nobody bugging them. Not yet. So.
Well,
no, not yet. And we do have some people that are continuing to mine in the old fashioned way with a dredge, as defined by the Fish and Game, and they haven't been hassled. They're just going, it's my right. You don't like it? Arrest me.
That's
and,
right.
And
yeah.
Once you arrest
and that's,
me,
and that's
then
all
I have
we can
cause.
Do as miners is just, you know, is basically assert our rights and say, okay, I'll, you know, if you want to come after my rights, I'll take my lumps. You know. Yeah,
well,
take one for the team, and I really appreciate guys like that when they do that. You know, the environmentalists don't like him, and they kind of beat him up in the newspapers when that happens. But from the perspective of a miner, if somebody's willing to say, "Hey, you know, stand up for their rights," that's all the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and the kind of stuff that they say about it, I again was drawn back to the Riverkeepers website. If you read it with a funny voice, it would be comedic, but mm-hmm. the problem is a lot of people believe these things.
Oh, they do, yeah.
And so, you know, you can almost hear the sad music, you know. Suction dredging directly kills aquatic insects, mollusks, fish eggs, fish larvae, amphibian eggs, and the amphibian tadpoles, and I'm thinking, who the hell cares? When they are entrained by the dredge, the gravel substrates of streams that once teemed with life suffer large losses. It's like, well, that is super scientific.
You'd think maybe they would pay us for, you know, if that's what happened, you'd think maybe they would pay us for killing mosquito larvae then.
Exactly.
You know, and doing the world a favor, getting rid of the mosquitoes that are usually just, during the summer, just terrible around the rivers and sometimes, especially on the Klamath.
Well, I noticed that, I mean, the language is very important. Extreme turbidity caused by excavating stream banks can have harmful effects on fish and other aquatic life. Suction dredging may mobilize elemental mercury. It's like, all this is false, therefore they use no definitive language.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that way they...
So then it's like, well, we didn't say it really did it. We said
it
may.
Yeah, and the biggest issue is, even when you get some of the mining legislation that's happened in California and also now in Oregon, we were fighting that, and unfortunately, you know, the Senate up here, the state Senate and the House, they just ignored us. You know, they ignored every bit of science. And it was kind of what we got out of our enemies was, well, this is our gut feeling that no matter how much science you show to us, and we had thrown something like 24 studies at them that actually cited for mining. And I think the environmentalists had like two on their side, and they were kind of questionable. But the people responsible for the legislation went, well, I've read all this stuff, and my gut feeling is it's bad.
Well, see, because they're reading stuff like, this is a two-page, like, a glossy pamphlet that they would print. This is the kind of stuff they would hand out at, like, a fair or whatever. It says here, and I think it's interesting that these two short sentences are meshed together. Noise, fumes, and turbidity caused by suction dredging make streams being dredged less desirable for swimming, boating, and fishing. Okay?
Right.
So once you get over that, very next sentence, dredgers sometimes leave unsightly messes of trash, gasoline barrels, and equipment in remote, pristine forests. Really, how many people would haul a barrel into a pristine forest?
Not very many. I do know where that came from. There was
there's always an idiot.
That actually arose from Dave Rutan's situation up here in the Calumet offices. Now, he actually, I know Dave, and he owns Oregon Gold Trips. And what Dave does is he has a tourism business, and it's mining related. And he is the only private property inside the Calumet-Opsis Wilderness. And it's a patented mining claim. It's called Emily Camp, and was named after Emily Cabot. And that was one of the oldest buildings in southwest Oregon until it burned up during the Biscuit Fire. And, you know, I do know that the former owner of that property actually accused the Forest Service of burning it up, but that's another story. But what happened, but basically what Dave does is it's remote, there's no road access, he flies his clients in and they go mine for a week and they pay for the privilege and they pay for this experience of being out in the middle of nowhere away from everybody and they go out there and they mine. Well, needless to say, when Dave brings fuel in, it comes in on the helicopter in a 55-gallon barrel. So, of course, on his property, he's got a couple 55-gallon drums stored. And that's where it came from, that they published photos of this here a few years ago after he started this, and they said, look at the mess out in the wilderness of the public lands, and it was actually on Dave's private property. And it wasn't a mess. It was just a 55-gallon drum.
Yeah. Well, because nobody's going to haul that
no.
to some wilderness, but people aren't going to typically be doing a ton of swimming or boating in the middle of nowhere either. I mean, people use areas that are close enough to get to.
Right.
It's just this whole picture that feeds into the, oh my gosh, it's like we have no trees. When I lived in Eureka, the whole big thing was they were cutting down the last of the redwoods.
Right.
Well, I mean, I had redwoods in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. At my house. You know, so did all my neighbors.
Well,
so,
here's another issue, okay? It is true that some miners do leave a mess behind, okay? But why are you going to penalize me for their illegal actions?
Right.
They are
exactly.
Because a few people act illegally, and it's true throughout the whole spectrum of our society. There are people who are going to speed. There are people who are going to park illegally. There are people who are going to use their cars to kill other people. Do we outlaw cars? No. But in the mining industry, there are some people who are going to leave their trash behind. So why are we penalizing a whole section of a population for a few people who choose to break the law? You know, this is not right. It never has been right and never will be right.
Well, because it isn't about facts, and we all know the
right.
environmental rallies and all that leave tons of garbage behind. I mean, that's been true forever. All right, so I guess it's like, all I ever say is, I guess we have to take a break. I mean, it's like I got to come up with a better line. A gorilla just ran through the building. We need to go check that out.
There you go.
Or not, I got to come up with something else. All right, we'll be right back with you here on We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM. We're going to go check that gorilla out right now. Well, Spandau Ballet.
We ran out, but the gorilla got away.
Oh, my goodness. Uh-oh.
Lost somebody.
There goes Mike.
I hope that was Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
It was.
Yeah, it wasn't me. Yeah.
We were chatting on the instant message thingamajigger here on the computer. And so he wanted to pop on and remind us about the cash business part of it that the government always hates. Classic.
And he is absolutely right in that regard.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny because as everything progresses, you know, down the road that we know it's going, there's going to be a cash black market. I mean, there's going to be a lot of businesses thriving. It's just the way it is. You can't stop the free market.
Right.
And human nature, no matter how hard you try.
No, but if you pick off small groups, you know, around the edges, they figure they can surround everybody. I don't think that's going to work out so good. But what?
Not based on that NRA dinner attendance.
No, the NRA dinner was a blowout. So you know, I think people are going to be okay with all this. Hey, Kirby, how can one of the things we spoke about yesterday was that even if people really don't have a ton of knowledge about mining and they don't have a problem with it. They don't know how to actively support it. They don't know what to say to people who would make comments about, oh, well, you know, mining, you know, this, like here was one of their statements on the stupid riverkeepers thing, it increases the turbidity in the streams. Well, that's actually good for fish.
Right.
It gives them food, and Mike actually shot me a little message in here that it helps with the predation. So right. The big fish can't eat the little fish if they can't really see them. So.
Right, and that was the Ward study I talked about earlier from the 30s. That was about hydraulic mining.
Yeah,
so that was on a mining on a much grander scale than anything we do now.
Right, but still, you know, there are benefits.
So that's not new research. This has been known for years and years and years.
So how can people support what you guys are doing? Where are good information sources that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to read about it, or videos that they can watch, or stuff like that?
One really good information source they can go to, one group that does a really good job of actually putting a lot of information together, and it's usually fairly balanced, is if they go to westernminingalliance.org. And the guys at Western Mining Alliance, they're actually a Nevada group that I think they're on, I think they're down there on the Nevada-California border outside the mother lode is where they're at. So they kind of buffer back and forth between both states, but they publish an awful lot of information on this. WaldoMiningDistrict.org also has a lot of information.
Well, like Waldo, like where's Waldo?
Yeah. Yeah, Waldo Mining District.
Yeah.
And I think in the past, I think you guys have actually had Tom Kitchar from Waldo Mining District on your show ages and ages ago, I think.
Actually, and I've talked to him on the phone, I believe. But we've listed some of them on the website.
Right.
So you have kirbyjackson.blogspot.com,
right,
where you post a lot of your writing. And then there's
right.
Southern Oregon Gold Mining. blogspot.com.
Right.
And then, you know, so as we think of resources, we should fire those out to folks.
Right. And you can also go to GaliceMining.com. That is the organization I'm with. It's Galice Mining District.
And it's G-A-L-I-C-E
Mining.com.
Okay.
And needless to say, if you actually go out and look, there's actually a lot of information out there. There's actually some pretty educational videos, and you can actually get both sides this way. And we don't want to be like the environmentalists and just give one side. We want people to have their free thought and make a decision. And kind of my attitude as a miner is, people don't necessarily have to like mining, as long as they're going to be reasonable about it. And this is kind of what I tell a lot of environmentalists, is they all have websites, and they have cell phones, and they drive cars, and they wear eyeglasses, and they have drinking glasses, and all of this comes from mining, that everything we use in society, it's either mined or it's grown. And that's true whether it's your food or whether it's something we use in society. It might be the nails in your house or the copper wiring for your electricity, the platinum in the hybrid cars and the nickel in the hybrid cars, and it's actually as a result of mining we actually have better, more efficient technology that's actually, by the environmentalist standard, it's better for the planet. All this comes from mining. We just need to decide, especially in this country, what kind of mining are we going to support? Are we going to support localized mining done by probably some guy who might be your neighbor, might be me, might be a guy in Happy Camp or something like that, where the metals come from? Or do we want to support, as I was talking to a guy from South Africa last night, Chinese conglomerates that go in and they go into some place like Africa and they buy up the minerals from the corrupt government, they employ small children, they don't have any environmental standards, there's no work standards, no labor standards, safety standards, all that's out the window. And the vast majority of our minerals, that's where they come from. And there was actually a pretty good series. I think it was published by Time. It was actually a photojournalist. He went over to the Philippines, and he was actually looking at the mud miners over there, and they're gold miners. And these guys, they're actually, a lot of them are small kids, and they are actually 100 feet down a mine shaft full of water in the mud, and these are little kids.
Yikes. I'm sure no accidents ever happen.
Yeah, and needless to say, me as a miner, I make a decision that I'm out there, I realize it's dangerous, I could get killed in the water at any time. A lot of things can happen, a boulder can fall on you, your airline can get pinched. Even if we're mining
above ground, and me and my partner do a lot of this. We're actually a little bigger than most of the small miners going around, as we actually do use an excavator and a wash plant, and we're running a little bigger. But, you know, I could easily get hit by the bucket off the excavator or a rock falls or something like that. Needless to say, that there's a risk involved, but I'm a big boy. I know the risks, and I take those. But it's not very good when we're relying on a mineral source that's largely utilizing child labor. You know, and needless to say, when we don't mine here, when we don't mine silica here or gold here or copper here, that's the system we're really relying on. And needless to say, most people, they're really not... No matter how much they hate mining, and I've had this conversation with environmentalists, is I've asked them, okay, you admit that, you know, mining is a necessity because you have your SUV and you have your eyeglasses and your electricity. And they go, oh, yeah, but I'd give it all up for the planet. And it's like, well, why don't you then?
Yeah, right.
And needless to say, you know, whether somebody is pro-mining or not, they need to... realize the fact that, you know, we are dependent on mining the same as we're dependent on farming, and people need to make a decision what kind of mining we want. Now, me personally, I'm actually also really interested in the elements of agriculture, and personally, me as a consumer, I would rather support the local farmer.
Yeah, know? Exactly.
And it's the same sort of scenario with the local food movement. You would actually think that the environmental movement, with what they did do that was positive with the local food movement, they would want a local mining movement, and they just don't. And the reason is it's really not about that. You know, it really is about who's controlling the land out there, and it's actually a different set of values. Like I was saying earlier, with this mining law we have that's very unique, we are unique in this country in that the people do own the minerals, but it's not a socialist brand of mineral ownership. It's not a collective ownership. It's each individually we can go out there and we can all become a miner on any scale we want to, and we can go out, find the minerals, make a discovery, we can appropriate it, we can develop it, and those are rights. Those are protected rights. The property that we claim as miners, that is protected under the Fifth Amendment.
And if somebody goes into the river on your claim, I mean, it's no different than it was back in the old West. They go on your claim and start mining on your claim, you have legal action you can take against them.
Oh yeah.
If another
miner comes onto my claim, it's a criminal charge. It's not just a civil action. It is a criminal offense in both California and Oregon. All the Western states, they all recognize this. And they have recognized it for years and years and years, almost since the beginning. So needless to say, there is an element of property involved. But where the miners are unique is that we are the guys out there on the so-called public land. And we're actually the only ones out there who actually do own a bona fide part of that that's not part of a collective ownership. So needless to say, if you have an agenda, you really have to get rid of the miners.
Sure.
Because we do have... regardless of the current court cases and kind of the way things have been going against the miners lately, we also have certain rights to the water the same way the ranchers do. You know, with the, you know, you had the, I think it's the daughter of Wayne Haig there on your show here a couple of weeks ago,
yeah,
and that
Haig.
Was Wayne Haig's water issues for his ranch that derived from the 1866 Mining Act was kind of the crux of his case. That's what it actually involved. There was actually a little bit of mining law involved.
That's what made me think of having a mining show, because we talked about that when Ramona was on.
Right. Yeah.
And these are all, this is part of our heritage, but it hasn't gone anywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, when you think about a claim jumper, because Mike that was on earlier had to go after a guy who jumped his claim and has done that a couple times. I mean, that still goes on. Those things still happen.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does. Yeah.
Okay, so the gorilla's running through the studio again.
No, we're going to go see if we won the lottery.
We're going to go see if we won the lottery. That's our new excuse.
Well, this time.
And so we'll thank our advertisers. But when we come back, I hope people go on wethepeopleradio.us. Go look on there. There is a thing about lead in the Oregon streams. And we'll have Kirby tell us about that. See you in 2 minutes.
My heart beating, time of the breathing. so. There's people out there mining music in the gold.
She got the gold mine.
She got the gold mine.
I got the shaft.
I got the shaft.
They split it right down the middle, and then they give her the better half. Well, it all sounds sort of funny, but it hurts too much to laugh. She got the gold mine, I got the shaft.
That goes down as one of my all-time favorites. That's a hilarious song.
That's a good one. Hey, Kirby, what was the song you were telling me about yesterday?
It's called Fire on the Mountain by the Marshall Tucker Band.
Oh.
And it's about a guy who leaves the Carolinas and he comes west for the gold rush, and he runs into some problems. He winds up dying at the end over a claim jumper.
Oh, we'll have to
kind of what you were talking about there at the end.
We'll have to sneak that in. I was telling Bob, I said there was some song you mentioned yesterday, but I totally forgot what it was. Hey, so before we run out of time, talk to us about the lead and also the mercury.
Because there's actually a video surface. This was shot here about 5 or 6 days ago on the Umpqua River, which is up here out of Roseburg, Oregon, which is about 60 miles north of me. So that's Roseburg is, I guess it's 100 miles north of Yreka is the best way to put it. And there were three miners working a stretch of the Umpqua River, and they've worked this area before, and they went through there, and I guess it's a really popular fishing hole. And they, in their dredges over 5 days, they ended up pulling out of the river with 7 5-gallon buckets of lead sinkers and rusty nails and fish hooks and all kinds of other nice things that were in the river. And as I mentioned earlier, with the process of how we mine, that basically what we do is we kind of sift through what's there on the bottom. And anything that's heavy, especially during a flood action, you know, or a high water event, everything that's in the river actually gets very churned up. If you go down to any of these rivers, especially the larger ones during the winter when there's a lot of water and a lot of snow melt going on, you can hear boulders crashing around down there because it's literally moving everything that's in the river. And basically what happens is anything that's heavy, it drops out into any low pressure zone. So that can be the inside of a bend in the river or where the river suddenly widens or where it gets very deep. And these are places that we as miners look for. And they had found one of those spots, and they got into this just huge mass quantity of lead. And this wasn't taken out of a big area. It was an area of about 50 yards in length. So it was 7 5-gallon buckets of lead. I'm not sure what the final weight was, but, I mean, that's incredible. And you have to figure that there's drinking water comes out of the Umpqua River. So this isn't our drinking water, and it's a result of things that do come out of the streams. It's buckshot, it's lead bullets, it's especially fishing sinkers and fishing hooks. And there's actually, if you ask me, there's actually a greater problem if these rivers are in any way impaired. There's actually more pollutants in them than, you know, that's something we should actually be concerned about, is the lead and the mercury that's in them and the chromite that's in them. And needless to say, these guys dredged up an awful lot of lead, and you guys have the video on your website. They can see it, and it's just absolutely incredible that, you know, you can see the one guy as he's unloading the second bucket, and they're sorting it out on a table for the video, and he's really having to go through a lot of effort to heave that second bucket up there because it lead's heavy.
Yeah. Well, so what they've done is they've taken all this lead out of the river, which would be a good thing.
Absolutely.
But I didn't remember reading about how that was being done.
You know, that's something that, you know, was there in the river that if it wasn't for those miners, it would be there forever until it got to the mouth of the Umpqua and went under the ocean. And a lot of that stuff, like with gold and anything like that, it takes a long time for it to move.
Sure. And
you
then,
know,
and,
you know, it could be in there for decades. You know, where I'm really into history, I mean, I know, I can kind of date things, you know, if I find remnants, square nails, you know, I know that square nails, you know, as an example, they stopped making them in about 1904. So if you find a square nail in the river, it's been there a long time.
Well,
you know, and you can kind of date things, and we come across a lot of trash when we're underwater mining like that, as we, you know, I've personally dredged up square nails, lead buckshot, fishing hooks, lead weights, broken glass. One time I nearly put my hand through a hypodermic needle that some drug addict obviously threw in the river there in the Applegate River. It was actually in a popular swimming hole is where it came out of. So if I wouldn't have gotten that out of there, somebody would have, you know, some kid would have put their foot through it. you know, there was still blood inside the syringe.
Ew.
You know, so that wasn't a good thing. And needless to say, when we are out there mining, we do come across things like that. I had a friend, he ended up finding earlier in this year, he found somebody's credit card that expired in like 1984, and it turned out to, he actually found the owner, and it was a guy who had been rafting on the Rogue River in the early 80s, and he fell out of the raft and lost his wallet. And all these years later, it turned up perfectly preserved on the bottom of the river. And a miner found it.
That's
and he called
funny.
Him and said, "Hey, do you want your credit card back?" And he said, "What credit card?" He said, "The one that expired in 1984. And he said, "Hey, I lost that. Where'd you find it?" And he said, "On the bottom of the river."
That's funny.
You know, and that is the sort of stuff we do come across, and people would be amazed what's out there in the river. There's cars in the rivers, there's remnants of bridges in the rivers, remnants of houses in the rivers. And needless to say, we do come across stuff like this, and when we find it, we don't throw it back. You know, we tend to, you know, almost every miner you come across, they've got a bucket of lead laying around.
Well,
you know, and
then,
eventually most miners, they'll save it for a while, and when they get a full bucket, they'll take it to the scrapper, and they'll pay for some fuel here and there.
That's cool. And then the mercury thing, that's a huge misnomer.
The mercury thing is, that's really a kind of a diluted issue. The first thing people need to realize is that here where we're all at, whether it's Southwest Oregon or Northern California, we have natural mercury. It comes in what's called cinnabar, and that is your basic ore of mercury. And when it reaches a certain temperature, it can actually leach out of the ore, and it will go into a liquid form. And needless to say, this can get into streams or it can pool. So we have a lot of mercury out there. And what the environmentalists claim is that, well, when the miners come along, they stir this up and it goes everywhere. And that's actually not what happens. Mercury is very heavy, and it's almost as heavy as gold, and it's usually in a liquid form. It looks like, when you see it, it looks like little silver drops, and it kind of moves funny. It's very heavy, and we can dredge that stuff up if we encounter it. And I have seen large pockets of it down in the rivers, and sometimes it's natural, sometimes it's not. And needless to say, when we hit those, we can actually pull that stuff out of the river. And it may be true that we have some losses, but 99.9% of it, we get that out of there. You know, and it's actually, they largely like to blame the old-timers, saying they were using an awful lot of mercury and that it was all got into the rivers and the old miners did it. But that's, you know, like I said, I know an awful lot about history and I know an awful lot about mining, and that's not something the old-timers would have done. They didn't fill their sluice boxes full of tubs of mercury. They didn't do that. You know, they actually had methodology for it. Mercury was something that was mined at the time. It was used in the mining industry, and it was considered a precious commodity. It was expensive. And so needless to say, people didn't waste it, and how they actually did it, they would actually apply it to a copper plate. And it was actually just a thin sheet. And so needless to say, when the amount of mercury they used is greatly exaggerated by people who really don't know how they were using it. And so like I said, there's an awful lot of it out there that's natural. There's probably very little of it that arose from mining or other issues. It's just something that's there. It's just like the gold and the chromite and that sort of thing. And needless to say, we can recover that thing. And it's actually when you find it and you're mining and you clean up for the day and you go through your sluice box, it's usually in the top of the box because it's very heavy. It's usually where the larger gold is. You can actually see it in there when you stop and you stop the water, and you can see it up there. And it's almost always in the top. And when it's in the top, that means you're not losing it. It's staying there, and you've actually recovered it quite efficiently. So that stuff is out there. We've got, in the Rogue River, we've got an awful lot of natural chromite that's in there because we have a lot of chrome. We did a lot of chrome mining during World War I and World War II, and there was an awful lot of it backed up behind the dams. And when they took the dams out, that stuff swept downstream, and it's actually become an issue where it's actually now polluting the water supply of the city of Grants Pass. And when they've treated it, it's actually converting it kind of like you would normally leach it out if you were actually mining on an industrial scale, and it's changing it into hexavalent chromium, and that is in our water supply now.
And that's thanks to a lot of the dam removal, which is what we have to look forward to.
That is, in my opinion, courtesy of certain environmental groups who pressed to remove the dams. And I do know, to their credit, I have heard that I think it's the Shastas there on the Klamath, they have actually
Yeah, I guess they're pro-dam removal, but as a result of that, they actually would like the miners to go in and dredge the
Shastas are not. It's the Kuroks that are pro.
There is actually some Indian group, though, from what I've heard, that they're actually saying, oh, we should actually dredge behind the dams before we remove them, because it could create an issue.
All right, Kirby, we have run out of time for the morning. We blow through 2 hours like a hot knife through butter. Hey, thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Talking about mining. I appreciate it.
Hey, good luck to Josephine County. Say hi to your sheriff up there.
Next week, we're talking about the NDAA.